Good morning, everybody, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, June 29th, 2025. The share ID numbers for Friday, June 27th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,562. That's 22562. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 22,563. That's 22563. This morning, A Vision for You presents Grief is Not a Defect. Overeaters Anonymous stands for the proposition that the 12 steps give us freedom from the bondage of our disease and sets us on a new path, clearing the way to the promises of recovery. OA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to compulsively overeat and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. We submit to a simple process that is certainly not easy, yet takes us to a place we've never been. Yet our efforts are required to sustain and enlarge it. Hence, the Big Book states that we trudge the road of happy destiny. Trudge, the definition, to walk or march steadily and usually laboriously. Those of us who trudge the road of recovery know that pain and challenges and at times grief are a part of life and part of the journey. However, during this adversity, we have a choice to implement the 12 steps and strengthen our reliance upon God. Trudging is the work of a lifetime, day in and day out. There are some hills we climb over and over again from the bottom up, day in and day out. Yet there are certain instances, certain fateful experiences, when dips and rises in the terrain of our destinies and lives reconfigure the altitude of our entire landscape. During these ordeals, we can either be tossed to the abyss or hoisted on high. Through the process of the 12 steps and a relationship with God, we are lifted and elevated to a different plateau. It is a design for living that works in rough going. Joining us today to elaborate on the fact that grief is not a defect is Melissa C., a recovered compulsive overeater from New York. Melissa is dedicated to the 12-step way of life and to carrying the message of recovery to those who still suffer. It's with great appreciation and always a delight to welcome Melissa C. to the line. Good morning, Melissa.
Hey, good morning, Leah. Thank you so much. Really happy to hear you do the intro this morning. It was really beautiful. And I just, you know, before I get started, I want to say I was listening to all my friends and fellows, like, chime in before the meeting and like, just claim their seat and say hi. And like, this beautiful piece overcame me. I feel like I'm going to get all weepy. Because this last, like, year or so has been a real challenge for me. And so many of those people's voices and names were really my source of great comfort, whether you knew it or not. But lots of you really did reach out to me, and it was incredibly meaningful and something that I really value and treasure. So it's my true appreciation to be able to speak on this topic today. I'm Melissa C. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I come from New York, from the beautiful Hudson Valley region of New York. And, you know, I want to say, like, I want to sort of get to, like, the most, probably the most exciting, happy thing of all is that throughout all of these obstacles, I've remained abstinent and free. Like, the food was quiet throughout all of these difficulties this last, you know, couple years, which is unbelievable because prior to that, you know, my joke was like the dog would, you know, make a mess and I would have to be in the refrigerator. So the fact that I can actually walk through some difficulties and not be even tempted to eat is miraculous. So I want to kind of share with you, like, I came back to OA in 2014 having experienced, I'd been in and out of OA before that. I had, you know, times of significant weight loss, periods of recovery, never recovered. But I was in and out, like that revolving door. And when I finally came back in 2014, I had experienced some very painful losses. And my struggle was to find a concept of God. You know, I had these losses, but my losses did not cause my compulsive eating. I was, like, well-practiced in the art of binge eating many years before I experienced my share of personal tragedies. And I always, like, want to be really clear that the difficulties are not why I ate. You know, we often hear, well, you know, a particular, someone will name a particular person in their life who died, and they'll say, you know, and that's why I started eating again. And not why I ate, you know. I ate because I'm a compulsive eater, and a compulsive overeater with no relationship with God and no understanding of what it means to have a design for living that works under all conditions. And I ate largely because I think because I had an ineffective belief system. You know, I believed, my belief was that God had screwed me, you know, cheated me and abandoned me. And there were periods of my life where I had, like, pleaded, you know, to God, I guess. I think it was to God for people to live, you know. And I felt the desire that I was feeling was, like, pure and loving and came from my heart and unselfish in nature and therefore worthy of God's intervention. It was like God ought to get in the way of this because this is worthy of God getting in the way of. And so it made it hard for me to find a connection with God. And I want to also say, like, hard but not impossible, obviously, right? Not impossible. And for me, the pain of obesity and the fact that I couldn't seem to help myself drove me back to OA. And, you know, like we say, we were beaten into a state of reasonableness. You know, in the end, I want to say that this disease was a blessing. It was a great gift. It was a miracle because what it did was, in a state of morbid obesity, it presented me with a necessity for God. And through this addiction, through my recovery, I found God, and I actually found a way to forgive God, right? As if God needed my forgiveness, but I needed to forgive God and to let God into my heart. And you know, I've also heard that God comes in through the wounds. That's where God entered my heart, through my wounds. So in the book, it says, and there's a solution on page 25, the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty, I always like to emphasize that, that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives, or hearts and lives, in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. So on my own, I could not change my attitude toward life, toward my fellows, and towards God's universe. My attitude actually stunk. You know, this program is about having an attitude adjustment. I was arrogant. You know, I had an attitude of arrogance. I had an exaggerated sense of my own importance, and I believe that bad things should never happen to me. Like, I had this unshakable belief that if I had a different set of circumstances, then I would be happy. Therefore, my circumstances needed to be changed. And I was full of self-pity. And there's a big difference between self-pity and sorrow. Self-pity, what I found, it pushes others away. It closes the door in receiving comfort. You know, it doesn't hear the voices of people who are offering you compassion and love. And self-pity, when I live with self-pity, what it gives me is an excuse for behaving in ways that are outside my own standards and outside the way that I believe my God would have me behave. It wants the world, you know, for me, I wanted the world to excuse my crappy behavior. You know, in self-pity, I needed to be in solitude, and it lived in this lie. And the lie was, you're all expecting me to show up, to go to work, to throw birthday parties, to socialize, to smile, to fake my way through life. And so you're going to get the worst part of me as I do that, you know? And it lived in the lie that others don't care. And it zoned in on where others are failing me. And I cursed the universe, you know, because it took what I believed was mine. And I had, for me, you know, to kind of, not that it really matters what my losses were, because, you know, every single human being, news alert, we're all going to experience tragedy. That's what it means to be human. We're all going to experience loss. But my particular circumstances was, in between my two living children, I had a number of very late pregnancy losses. Like, you know, when you're well past the point of what you believe to be safe, when other people are generally noting that you're pregnant, I had losses at that point, and it was really difficult. It was a difficult time in my life. And then, like, to top it off, we had a son that was born prematurely, and he lived a day and then died. And then, right, to compound it, shortly thereafter, my best friend died. Then another close friend died, you know, and then my father-in-law, and then my father. And it was like, I was convinced there was this black cloud following me around, you know. I saw the people in my life that had passed, especially my son and the pregnancies, but that they belonged to me. And I walked around angry at people, and mostly women. Like, that's the truth. I was so mad at women who were able to have healthy babies and increase their families, and they had what I knew was meant for me. Like, I've been a teacher for many years. I've been the favorite aunt of all my, I was the youngest, you know, sibling, so I was like the most favorite aunt of all my nieces and nephews. I was certain that I was supposed to have this big family, and others were getting what I wanted. And I was jealous. Like, I walked around in a state of jealousy, and I would cringe when I saw a baby, and I hated myself for being this way. And yet I couldn't change my attitude. You know, I had this, it's a deep-rooted selfishness. I did not want others to get what I believed was mine. And I saw the good things that others got as evidence that there wasn't going to be enough for me. And really, what I did not understand was God's economy. You know, in God's economy, good gets multiplied and not divided. You know, it operates, I think, in the same way that love does. When I see others get things, you know, that I want, I see it as a demonstration that, wow, those things can definitely happen. They can offer me hope. It's kind of like, you know, where there's love, it grows more love. And it's not this pie that gets divvied up just because someone got some, then there's less for me. You know, and jealousy, though, like, tells me that there's only so much to go around. And really what happened was my jealousy turned me into someone I didn't like very much. It was like I wasn't just experiencing the loss of the people I loved, but I was experiencing the loss of me, the essence of who I was. And you know, I want to contrast what it was like then to what it was like now. And, you know, when my dad was diagnosed with cancer, my mother and my siblings kept it from me. And when I found out, like, I went crazy. I went ballistic. I screamed and I carried on like a crazy person. Like, I was angry at them. And my mom had said they didn't want to tell me because they didn't want to upset me. And you know what that did? That got me even angrier because I said, like, there's something really wrong with you people. You think I'm not supposed to be upset, you know? But when I realized, as I worked my 12 steps, you know, years later, when I came to recovery and I had to inventory and I had to look at these things, when I realized that my upsetness was a burden to them, that my grief was a burden. And I have to tell you, that's nothing like the way that I've experienced my current difficulties. Like, these past few years, you know, my beautiful mother began exhibiting symptoms of dementia. And then, you know, just this past April, she passed away. And this entire process has been an entirely different experience. In fact, the last time I was scheduled to speak, actually, I had to cancel the last minute because it was my mother's funeral. And so, like, it's really beautiful to be able to talk today. And obviously that was not going to be my topic back then. You know, it was, I think it was like step three. But today it's like I have something useful to share about this. So on page 29, like, let's get into the book now. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and in my own language, from my own point of view, the way that he established his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what actually happened in their lives. So that's my charge here today, like, and always, right? My charge is to use my personal story, to use my experiences to explain how I established my relationship with God. And I do it because I actually believe that that's what I'm being called to do. I don't believe that God, like, had this happen to me with the intention of having me do this work. But I actually believe that God wants me to take my pain and transform it into something that's useful and hopefully beautiful. And, you know, so I'm pretty certain I was born a compulsive overeater. You know, my earliest memories are of food. And like I said, I cannot say that I became a compulsive eater because of any loss or tragedy, because I had this beautiful, idyllic childhood, you know, full of flawed people, but nothing real tragic. And I was eating, like, at a very young age. And I think what it is that I got this idea that pain and discomfort, like, I think all people, must be avoided, you know, skipped over and ignored, you know. And the other idea that I got was, or you could take your losses and pain and parade it around and use it as your excuse. And, you know, and for me, being a compulsive eater, you know, it gave me access to a way of getting high and skipping hard feelings. Like, I could, you know, I could, at a young age, I could get high right in front of everybody, you know, with the food, and I could skip over hard feelings. But, you know, we really don't get to skip anything, right? What happens is I can postpone the inevitable of experiencing pain. And so what's different today is I don't try to skip my pain, you know. I don't, like, seek out opportunities to feel great pain. I'm human. I'm supposed to, like, you know, avoid it. But when it comes, I don't cry. I reach out for help. I have a position of humility. I tell others what I'm going through, and I do what I believe God is directing me to do, generally, regardless of what is going on around me. You know, like, God gives me the assignment, and I'm supposed to be laser-focused on my assignment, you know. And we agnostics, on page, let's see where it is. Well, it talks about when this man cries out, you know, if there is a God, he certainly hasn't done anything for me. And boy, did I feel that way. You know, and then he comes to this thought, like, who are you in his head? Who are you to say there's no God? You know, and I love that story because it's that inner coming to yourself, like that inside thing that happens. And the line that I love is that he's overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God, that that thing happens inside. And that happened for me, that, you know, it further goes on to, you know, speak, and it says, he stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in conscious companionship with his Creator. And so I say today, you know, I live in a state of being awake to a friendship with God. Like, I feel God's presence. And I love, like, that infinite power line and love, because that's the way that I feel his presence. I feel the sense of infinite power within and around and infinite love. And, you know, I didn't always feel that way. You know, after years of suffering with the disease of compulsive overeating, what happened for me was I reached a point where the food just stopped working. Like, I couldn't get numb. It didn't work. And that was a blessing, but at first it felt like a curse because, you know, I was having these panic attacks on my way to work, and I would try to be abstinent. I would, like, try to not eat things with sugar. And that was my definition of abstinent at that point. And so I would have these bags of shredded wheat in my cereal in my car, because the other thing that, you know, it had a digestive effect that I liked, right? So I would eat all this shredded wheat, and I was eating it this one particular morning, and my gums were bleeding, and it hurt so much to eat it, and I couldn't stop eating it, and my mouth, you know, I'm grateful that I have that memory and that it's burned in my brain, because my mouth was killing me as I was chewing, and I had a taste of blood in my mouth, and I kept on eating. And so that was my bottom. It was no longer I eat because I like food. I was like, I'm eating because I'm really sick. And at 300 plus pounds, I finally realized I couldn't live with the food anymore. And what happened was shortly after, I began to work the steps with all the seriousness of a drowning man. You know, I surrendered. I just didn't care at that point what I was told to stop eating. Like, I was told, like, okay, don't eat this. Like, you know, like, you're going to have to do this. I stopped negotiating, and I began to follow directions. And then at step two was where I hit my first huge stumbling block. And I didn't know that I could come to believe in a power that could restore me to sanity. Like, how could I consider that God would intervene with my food when he hadn't intervened with my other losses? And how could that be? And, you know, in Bill's story, it talks about that, you know, Ebby comes to Bill and he has this conversation, and Bill's like, yeah, I don't like this idea of a God personal to me. Like, he didn't like that idea. He could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence. I liked that. Okay, something creative, intelligent, a universal mind or a spirit of nature. Yeah. I liked that, but resisted the thought of the stars of the heavens, however loving his sway may be. I've since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. And then my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required to make my beginning. Right? Nothing more. Just a willingness to believe. And I want to say, like, as someone who, you know, has the joy of getting to sponsor people, I often get outreach from people who are like, but I don't believe in God. And it's like, okay, but are you willing? Meaning, do you want to? Like, do you want to believe in God? Because nothing more is required to make that beginning. And I saw that growth could start at that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. When I have it, of course I would. You know, and with that, it says like a new world came into view. You know, and so for me, a stumbling block was that icy intellectual mountain that they speak of here. I really understood the concept of my mind being broken. Like, I got that in step one. Of course, my mom was broken. I was eating shredded wheat cereal till my mouth bled, and I still couldn't stop. So I knew that I was broken. I could not rely on my thinking. I didn't like that, but I got it. And yet, in step two, I interpreted it as, now you want me to use my broken brain and create my own concept of God. And that seemed to me like a scam, like a hoax, like a trick. You know, which is it? Is my mind broken or not? And it, could I make up God with a broken mind? And for me, you know, I was playing like mental gymnastics to sort of work myself out of believing. And I had this moment where I heard, you know, I heard this voice in my brain, and I knew it wasn't really the voice that I was hearing, but I heard it like this. I heard, you know, I heard my father's voice. I heard my father, who had been gone, in my head say, stop being so smart. Like, you don't know it all. Do you want to get better or not? And that, I always think, is the greatest question that I was ever asked. You want to get better or not? And I've discovered that I could really rely on a power that I couldn't understand. You know, and then I had sponsors who took out the AA 12 and 12 and pointed me to the text and reminded me about electricity and how I don't really understand it, right? And I'll tell you, I know that there's generators and that there's power lines that are outside my house and that there's, I don't know, there's something in my basement that does something to the outlet in my bedroom. And I know, like, if the lights go out in my house, I might, like, call down to my husband, like, hey, babe, can you look at the breaker? I don't understand any of it. Like, you know, and yet I turn on my lamp, right? And I rely on it because it helps me see in the dark, and I don't have to worry about understanding it. So I can rely on power that I don't understand. And I was also told that I don't have to understand God at this point. And in fact, I'm never promised that I'm going to understand God. What I am promised is that all I ever need is a willingness to believe. And I've discovered that this incredible power does not have to make sense to me. You know, it can morph, it can evolve, it can change, it can grow, it can even contradict, you know, and I can accept this today, that I'm too small. I'm too earthly to comprehend a power so great. And that, for whatever reason, gives me peace. I have no problem in believing that God can relieve me of the desire to eat compulsively. Because guess what, guys? He has, right? He has. He has relieved me of the desire to eat compulsively, even in the midst of difficulties. So now to how it works in page 62 to 63 in paragraph 3, it says this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Okay, so if I'm not this great power, then I can't walk around pretending that I am. Hereafter, in this drama of life, God's going to be the director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc through which we passed to freedom. When we sincerely took such a position, the position that God is my director, right? That God is in charge, all sorts of remarkable things follow. I have a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed, not always what I wanted, by the way, if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs, and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life, even, I want to say, like I'm going to add here, even through periods of loss How can I contribute to life? As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, yes, even through hard times, as we became conscious of His presence, awake and aware of God with me, even during difficulties, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. So in step three, I turn my will and my life, that means my thoughts and my actions, over to God. And throughout this last year or so, you know, each day I have a very serious prayer and meditation practice. I say serious with like a great smile because I love it so much. It's so important to me. But every day I would just keep asking God for my assignment. Like I stopped praying not for my mother's dementia to be cured, not to try to fix her, like help me see how I'm going to fix her, but rather God to help me surrender. I asked others in the fellowship for help, and I listened to those that were living in peace. And the number of fellows that offered me their direction and their peace, everything from prayers that they found effective to like quotes and just their own experiences and hope. I mean, if I started naming names, it's unbelievable what we get from the fellowship. I was moderating at a meeting one time, and I heard someone share a prayer that had nothing to do with a mother. His had to do with his love life. And it was a third step prayer. And it moved me so deeply that I took his third step prayer and I said to him, your prayer moved me so completely. I'm going to take your prayer and I'm going to rewrite it for my mom, for my situation with my mom. And, you know, and so his name is Michael S. from L.A., and he shared about surrendering, like, his love life. And I took it, and I rewrote it. And it's the third step prayer, and I'm going to share it because I think it's beautiful, and it's, like, really right from the book, pretty much. And God, I abandon myself to you, my whole self without reservation. I abandon my worries and concerns about my mom and her dementia to you, God, even though I have trouble believing that you can change this area for me. God, I'm willing to believe. I give you my obsessive thinking in these areas, my constant willfulness and fear that I have to figure it out and be better and solve and make things happen. God, my way has not worked and it doesn't seem to. God, I know that you are real. And I humbly ask for a change of heart here, a change of mind. I'm willing now to trust you with my heart and with my mother's life. I humbly ask that you hear my prayer. Show me you hear it. I'm tired of God, of feeling so sad and frightened. Please take it. Take my abandon and show me how you would have me be. These difficulties, my difficulties, have outlived their usefulness. My old thinking does not serve. Relieve me, God, of this heaviness and show me that you are big enough to handle this. I am willing. Take my self-will so I can better do yours because mine is a prison. May your victory over all my challenges create in me a softer heart and a deepened faith. May it bear witness to my mother, my siblings, my friends new and old, my acquaintances and family members, of your extraordinary grace and the love you have for me and for us. May my love for my mother and my siblings be a great fact that proves your existence. And when I feel the need to fix or solve, please remind me, God, of who I am and who you are, and gently show me that you are running the show so I don't have to. Please help me, Lord. I need a miracle. Amen. And I would say that prayer every day, truly asking to be obedient to God. Like, that's what I was asking for, and here's what I discovered. My happiness is not dependent on my circumstances. My happiness is dependent on living according to my purpose. I felt this very clear direction, like spend as much time as possible with mom. I would just, it was like friends would say to me, you don't have to go there every day. And here's what God did. God took what I believed I did have to do, and he turned it into what I wanted to do. And so out of my mouth came, I know, but I actually want to. And I would find by the end of my day at work, I would be like, you know, when I was a little girl, what used to get me through my school day was the thought of the cookies in the cupboard at home. Here I am at work, a grown woman. What was getting me through the end of my day was, oh my God, I'm going to get to see my mom shortly. I'm going to get to see my mom shortly. And that was God's gift to me. Like I could not make myself want to do something, but God gave me that gift. And so what I would do is I would bring my mom an ice cream every day because my mother loved ice cream. And I started to appreciate her retelling me the same stories over and over. And I started like videoing her telling me them. And then I was able to see over time her ability to communicate, her ability to tell those stories, she lost. And so I would be able to hear just snippets of it and get comfort, you know. And what I do, when I do what I believe God is asking me to do, then I can do difficult things. And I get an internal sense of joy and strength. The things that I would have found too difficult, they're not. I actually, what I say was, I always loved my mother. You know, I always loved my mother. I was my mother's baby. But I actually fell in love with my mother. In her last state of her life, she was like a child. And I fell in love with the childlike version of my mother. I saw that I was being given a unique gift. Not everybody gets to experience their mother as a little girl, but I did. And I got to hold her hand. And I felt the gift of her physical presence. And I got to bring her comfort because I could see sometimes my mother wouldn't recognize me. And then I would see the moments in her face when she did. And I will never forget the way that her face would light up when she saw me. Nobody in my life has ever had their face light up like that when my mother saw me at that time. And so being sad is not a defect. Like, you know, but I can get resentful at the things that I believed were contributing to my sadness. And thankfully, the resentment is something that we have a way of handling. You know, on page 66, paragraphs 1 through 2, it says, it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander, we waste, right? Squander, waste the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. Deadly, we find it fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of the alcohol returns when we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men. But for alcoholics, these things are poison. You know, so I'm a member of a very large family. And as a member of a large family, I have a sister, I have a brother-in-law, I've got lots of brothers, I have sister-in-laws, I have ex-sister-in-laws, I have nieces, I have nephews, I have their spouses, I have kids, I have a husband, you know, I have lots of people in my life, which is a blessing, but there's also lots of personalities and lots of opinions and lots of perspectives, and in the course of my mom's decline and death, there were plenty of resentments that came up. And, you know, I don't want anyone to think here that I just skated through this time happy and You know, I definitely had my share of resentments towards people. And I'm grateful that I have an inventory practice that includes for me a sisterhood and a fellowship, because I have people who can offer me compassion and kindness, but they don't enable me. You know, I have people who, when I start talking about my brother-in-law, they know the whole damn story. We can cut right to the chase, and they can move me quickly, you know, to what the solution is. And, you know, I remember calling my friend. I had a couple friends here that I called over my brother-in-law, but I remember really specifically, like, I think it was right after my mom had died, I called my friend Janet, and I needed a minute. I was like, I am so angry at my brother-in-law. I don't even remember what for now. How's that? But it was like on the many list of things that he did that, you know, whatever. And I said to her, I just need a minute to be pissed off. I just want to be mad. I just got to tell you what he did, and I just need a minute to be pissed off. And here's my beautiful friend said to me, okay, but that's about all you get. You know, you can't afford much more than that. And thank God I have friends like that. Thank God for all of you here, you know, that, when I got upset with one of my brothers who wasn't doing what the hospice nurses and doctors suggested, what I was directed to was, that's not your lane. That's not your business. Let the nurses and doctors talk to him. You're not God. Stop trying. And I found out, you know, I was, you know, the part of the stage director where they talk about forever trying to manage the lights, the scenery, the back. I actually was trying to control the lighting in my mother's room as she was dying. I wanted a certain lighting. And I laughed because it was like, oh yeah, I was trying to play God. Let the nurses and doctors have that. And when I did that, I was able to find compassion for him rather than gossip about him with our other siblings. And when I got overly controlling and bossy, like I did, you know, at one point we were all in the room together. My brother said something, and we were all there together, all the players. And apparently I made the look. I'm a teacher, and I guess I got the teacher face. And my siblings busted out laughing at me, right? It was like a very difficult time. We're like in the throes of great sorrow. They all started laughing at me. And they're like, oh, that's the look you give to your students. And I was able to, you know, kind of stop taking myself so seriously and actually realize that there was an amend that I needed to make. I needed to stop trying to be the boss of anybody. And so here I go too, throughout all of this, right? All these visits to the hospital, all this time with my mom in hospice. You know, I look at, there's some photos taken at this period of time, and if you look closely in all the photos, you can catch a glimpse of my little lunchbox, because, like, I'm a compulsive overeater, and I left the house each day, and sometimes, you know, for time, with my cooler and lunchbox packs, you know. I continued to weigh and measure my food, bring my food where I went, just like I continued to, you know, brush my teeth and put on deodorant. And I continue to stay in close contact with my sponsors and sponsees. That's part of my, you know, it's part of how I work my program. Page 67, paragraph 3 says this. It talks about fear. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside with the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, right, the employer, the wife, and that this short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. That it's an evil and corroding thread, right? And then it says, like, we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection to them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. And so there is a better way. We're on a different basis now, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, He enables us to match calamity with serenity. That's really what I did. I trusted God rather than myself. I tried to just play the role that I believed He was assigning me, and that if I kept relying on Him, He helped me match this calamity with serenity. I actually would feel calm, you know? And so I don't apologize to anyone for depending upon my Creator. I can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. And at once, we commence to outgrow fear. And so if I'm going to contrast this with my earlier periods of grief, right, prior to recovery, early in my recovery, I had this thought that it was unfair for anyone to expect me to let go of my fears. Like, after all, I just told you all of the losses I had. I am entitled. I even said, I'm entitled to be afraid. I'm entitled to my fear. And then, you know, I had this other voice that kind of came into my head, you know, and it was, to me, it was like, it's the voice of my Creator. It's this. It sounds just like my voice, but it's something I would never say. And the voice I hear is, no, no, no. You're entitled to much better than that. Like, you're not entitled to fear. You're entitled to freedom. And that's what God has shown me. That, you know, my life was a precious gift, and I was wasting it. And, you know, I had children that early in recovery, when I was working on my inventory, you know, I began to realize I had children that were living. They were here. I had a husband that was here. You know, they deserved a mother and a wife. And I suddenly saw, you know, I had all this resentment towards my sisters and brothers, largely because they had huge families. Like, that was my resentment. And when I really worked my inventory, I suddenly saw that my sister and brothers had been so good to me throughout my losses. You know, when my son had died, I forgotten, and then I remembered that they arranged the entire funeral. My sister had even eulogized my child. My friend, you know, I had a friend that had four daughters. She was one of my best friends, and I was really, I had a hard time being in her company because she had children. And in my inventory process, it came clear to me that she was the first one to come to my house, like, with dinner for my husband and my daughter, that she would bathe my daughter when I couldn't do it, when I just couldn't get myself together, and that she and her husband called my husband all the time. They continued to call him, and they gave him a place to share his pain. He didn't have to be careful around them. And, you know, my mother, when I was going through this period, she used to say to me, Melissa, you got to get yourself together. You got to get yourself together. Just put on your lipstick. And that, I was so angry at her for saying that to me. And I realized in my inventory, my mother didn't want me to cry. You know, not because she didn't think I had a right to cry or she was mean, because it hurt her. And that, you know, if I could just put my lipstick on, then maybe I was going to pull myself together. Maybe I would be okay. And then through the steps, I had been transformed. I don't really remember how it was, but I found myself able to think of God as a power of good, even though the loss of someone that I loved was anything but good. And so here I go, right? I rarely felt afraid when my mom was dying. You know, a few times I had some true self-centered fear, And like one of which was like the fear that I'm going to get dementia one day because my grandmother had it, just like my mother, you know. But now I really don't give that too much attention. I don't give it too much thought, you know. I trust that if that is my path, then like God will continue to be with me in my difficulties. And like one of the jokes I kind of tell my kids is, like, wherever I go, just make sure they have really good fresh fruits and vegetables. Really vegetables. I really like my fresh vegetables. And, you know, and let there be good music. And I know I'll make a friend because I always make a friend wherever I go. So, you know, many years ago when I took my fifth step with my sponsor, I needed to do it in two sessions because the first one gave me some awareness. But then I had this sense that I hadn't told everything. You know, when there's that time when you're told to, like, meditate and ask yourself if there's anything that you've left out or you're trying to make mortar without sand, it came to me in my quiet meditation, oh, yeah, I had something I had to talk about. And for me, it's, I had all this guilt over the death of my child. Like, I was hanging on to all this guilt and real or imagined, I don't know, but I needed to say it out loud and so that I could get it out of my brain. It was that marble that was rolling around in my brain, and I knew that if I didn't get it out, I might have eaten again. And I didn't want to go back to bloody gums, you know? And so I made this appointment, and I got together with my sponsor, and we actually, like, we met in a church. After our meeting was in the basement of the church, and after the meeting, we went upstairs, and I told her everything, and I just, like, I sobbed. I remember I just sobbed with, like, abandon. I just let it all out, and she listened, and what I saw was all this compassion in her face. There was no judgment. There was just love, and, you know, she said to me, I remember she looked at me, and she said, Melissa, I really feel like God's forgiven you. And I don't know, God entered my heart that day in a way that I had never experienced. I truly felt the nearness of my Creator. I knew something miraculous had taken hold of me. I remember I left the church that day. I walked outside. I looked at the sky and the trees against the blue sky. Everything looked different. I saw the world differently. And really, the desire to eat was like yanked right out of me. You know, in step 6 and 7, it's not terribly difficult in theory. I thought, yeah, of course I'm willing to have God remove my defects, and I humbly asked him. But I learned that really what I wanted more than anything was the consequences of my defects removed. And digging deeper, you know, I was taught that there was a difference, that if I was truly willing, then a person who's willing is a person who takes action. Like, because willingness without action is just wishing. So my actions are going to demonstrate my willingness, and that from here on out, I am entering a partnership with God. And I live in ways where I try my best not to practice my defects, and that God will remove the things that are no longer useful to him. In steps 8 and 9, you know, when it came time for me to make amends, I saw that I did owe certain people a direct apology, and but I, more than anything, was my life, the way that I was living. I was going to have to make some living amends, you know, like to my children for not participating in the often physically demanding roles of motherhood, you know, and my husband for, like, requiring him. He had to fill in all the gaps where I couldn't do the things that needed to get done. I had to stop criticizing and start being helpful. You know, I made direct amends to my siblings, who at times I had treated horribly, and to friends. You know, I finally acknowledged how good my siblings had been to me, and it was really hard for me, but I went to my sister and I told her how much it meant to me that she eulogized my son, and I reread the beautiful words she wrote. And then I found myself, when I did that, flooded with all the memories of how when she had spoken that day, her tears for me. And, you know, and what the steps did was it allowed me to see the truth. God never abandoned me. Like, throughout my life, he's consistently supplied me with everything that I needed to survive the unimaginable. And, you know, and I owed an amend to the memory of the people I loved who had died, you know. Used their death as an excuse for not living fully. And that's pretty crappy, you know. People deserve to have their memories honored, not polluted and exploited, not used as, you know, as an excuse. So a living amend meant living my life fully and in ways that was meaningful and with a purpose. And boy, do we get to do that in this program, don't we? We get to live with meaning and purpose and use our experiences, you know, to do good with. I experienced all those nine-step promises, you know, that page 84 talks about. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness, like freedom from my grief, happiness even through the difficulties. We're not going to regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Yes, I had this intuition. I knew how to handle situations now I never would have known how to handle before. In steps 10, 11, and 12, you know, I keep practicing what I've learned, and I do my best to clean up my mistakes as I go along. I have entered the world of the spirit, and my function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. I watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. You know, I am an imperfect child of God. I make mistakes all the time. But I love living in the world of the spirit. And so I try to do whatever I'm directed to do so I can continue to live there. And I think it's important, you know, like my title of this talk is, it's important to point out that sadness is not the defect. Grief is not the defect. I can't 10th step my grief away. God created me, you know, as a human being, like a woman with tremendous capacity to love. And, you know, I read this somewhere, I think I joke, like somewhere really spiritual, like Facebook, you know, haha. I read, grief is just love with no place to go, right? And I've learned, like, where do I go then? I go to God with my grief, and my Creator sits with me when I'm sad. And I no longer have to run, and I don't have to hide from my human emotions. I can give them the right space, and I can take comfort from my loving Creator. The amazing thing is that as I seek my comfort from God, my grief lessens. It finds its rightful place, and God has consistently placed people in my life who I can help. I've learned how to sit beside others when they're sad, and just let them be sad and just give them the comfort of our friendship. You know, and here's the crazy thing. About a week or two after my mom died, one of my sponsees, my dear sister in program, lost her mom. And I saw, like, how important it was that both of us had each other, right? And it was so important that I remained recovered throughout this process, because who else was supposed to help her? You know, not that she didn't have that benefit of other people, and I'm by no means God, but I had an experience, like in the moment experience, where I could happily share or not so happily share what was going on and how we could work this thing together. And although, you know, this talk is about grief, I want to leave you with this thought. It's found on page 133 in the family afterword. We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. We cannot subscribe to the belief that this life is a veil of tears though it once was just that for many of us. But it is clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid then the deliberate manufacturer of misery. But if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence. And truthfully, that's exactly what I hoped I'd been able to do this morning. And with that, I pass. Thanks.
Oh, Melissa, thank you so much for this very rich and profound and moving, beautiful presentation this morning. So very touching. Thank you. Share ID for today, 22,564. That's 22564. Another gem for our archives. Thank you so very much for all that you gave to us, Melissa. Melissa's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this meeting, so do stay tuned for that. We will now transition to a question and answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, and one question per person, please. You can do so by pressing star one to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name. I do have Elena C.
Cindy B.
Danny P.
Victoria L.
Mary F. I have, yes. I have Elena C., Cindy B., was it Danny C., Gloria L., Mary F.?
Anayeta.
Got you. Anayeta.
Deborah M.
No, I'm Deborah M.
Chris G. in Tennessee.
And Chris G. Let's stop there, please. And we'll begin with Elena C. Again, comment questions only, please. And one question per person. Thank you. Go ahead, Elena.
Good morning, everyone. I am very sorry, Leah, for cutting you off. And I thank you, Melissa. That's exactly what I need to hear. I'm going to
Elena, press star one, please.
Can you hear me?
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Elena, please.
Your question. Okay, so, yes, Melissa, thank you. You spoke about many gifts you've gotten from your midst of your losses. What is the biggest gift of all that you have gotten?
Okay, I remuted myself. I would say, you know, the biggest gift of all that I got is the awareness of God with me, like a sense of his knowing. Yeah, that's really it. I mean, I feel a great sense of God with me through all this loss. And then maybe the gift that God gave me in turn is, I think it's grown my capacity to have empathy for people.
Thank you, Elena, for your question. Next question, Cindy B.
Hi, this is Cindy B. from Boston. Melissa, thank you. What a beautiful morning I've had listening to you. Thank you so much. There were many jewels, but one that you just stood out is that grief is just love with no place to go. And I was wondering, because I know when I went through withdrawal with food, there was a lot of grief around it. And I'm wondering if, and you also talked a lot about surrender today, I wonder if you can take that quote and and talk about the surrender about food in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, to be honest, the love of the food, that grieving of the food, it's a lie. It's a lie manufactured by the disease to keep me right on eating, because I don't know about your eating, but my eating, only the first bite was the one that might have given me a moment of that. But the consequences that immediately followed was like extreme horror. It was not social. It was the most antisocial action I could take. It could, you know, so like the grieving of the food, in the early recovery, what it is it's like, what do I do now? What do I do with all this? I found, like, what the hell do I do with all this extra time? Because I couldn't, I mean, the amount of time that I spent on gathering my food, eating my food, having to hide it, having to, I mean, it took up a great chunk of my day, and it was like I had all these hours now with which to fill. And I think what satisfied that grief was the work of the program. You know, when people say, wow, that's a lot of work, yep, because I needed it. I needed a lot of diversion. I needed a lot of things to fill that space, and thank God we've got a program that does it. So, yeah, I don't think there's nothing loving about my relationship with food. It was not love. It was a lie. It was bondage. Thanks. I'll pass.
Thank you, Cindy B. Danny, Danny C. All right, perhaps not. Gloria L.
Hi, good morning. Can I be heard?
Oh, there we go. Yes. Okay, I was wondering.
Thank you.
Hi, Danny. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your service, Leah. Good morning, everyone. I'm Danny P. God's grace, I'm Brazil. Melissa, wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for this wonderful, powerful, big book message. So beautiful and very helpful to someone like me who has been facing a lot of grief and losses. My question for you, you said that you believe that God wants you to use all this pain to be helpful and useful to others. You gave an example that illustrates with your sponsee. Could you give us more examples how God has been using all this pain to help you to be useful to others? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, we're those of us, right, we're active in a fellowship. We've got great opportunities to share within our community here. And the other, for me, is like within my family, within, you know, I was able, like, my siblings, I mean, I'm the youngest, right? My whole life, they've been the big ones, the grown-ups in my mind, and I've been the child. You know, that's sort of, like, we joke, like, I'm the baby. I'm 56 years old, I'm the baby. And, but what happened really was I got to grow up, and I was actually able to be extremely useful to my siblings who, they did not have the same ability to surrender to the reality of how my mother was. So I had siblings who would say to me, one of my brothers would call and say, listen, I told mom, you've told me that story already. Let's talk about something else. He's like, I'm going to snap her out of this. I keep trying to bring up other things because she's just not think, you know, she's just, he was like treating it like it was laziness. And I was able to like point out to him in a loving way, like, I don't think this is laziness. I think this is the best that mom can do. And, you know, and I shared with him, like, I try to listen as though I've never heard that story before. Like, I would say to my brother, like, I would tried this, it's almost discipline, like an exercise, let me hear this story as though I'd never heard it before, and ask her questions about this story that she might want to talk more about, like to try to, and I was able to help my siblings with that, and even just, I had the stomach for things that they didn't, you know, like I could do things physically for my mother that I, and no judgment on their part. It wasn't that they didn't love my mother. They loved my mother as much as I do, you know, but I was able to sort of, and not use it as a weapon against them. Well, I've done all this and you're not, I didn't even, you know, like one of my brothers would say, I feel really bad. You know, you go so much more than I do. And you, and I was like, let's not do that. Like, I don't worry about how I'm going, whether you go or not. I just want to go because I want to go. And I think that that was a great source of comfort for my family as well. And I think for my children, I think my children got the benefit of seeing what it looks like to experience loss, pain, grief, fully, you know, even relying on them at times. Sharing with them how I was feeling, you know, that this is really hard for me. I'm struggling here. This is difficult. And allowing them opportunities to grow their muscle of compassion. So there's been incredible gifts all around here. Thanks. Thanks for the question, Danny.
Thank you, Danny P. Gloria L., your turn.
Could you have meant Victoria L.?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Okay. Go ahead, Victoria.
Thanks. Good morning. This is Victoria L., and I'm a compulsive overeater. I live in Muncie, Indiana. Melissa, thank you so much for sharing how you used an active program of recovery to get through really difficult and emotional and vulnerable times in your life. Question for you. What would you say to anyone on the line who's still struggling with perhaps self-reliance instead of God-reliance? And then, yeah, well, one question. So, yeah, that's my question. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, it's difficult because, and I would, I have to say, sometimes I teeter back and forth. Like, I would be like, I have to do blank, 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 blank. And then it was like, wait, why? What's, it, am I, do I really believe that God is asking me to do this? Or am I doing this because I believe I'm supposed to do this? Is there some sort of, you know, rule that I have in my brain about I need to do this kind of a thing rather than, and I found, you know, the difficulty with relying on God versus reliance on self is I have to, for me, one of the biggest things is stop worrying what other people think. Stop worrying what other, because like, I mean, I'll give you an example. I think examples are like the best way to explain. My attendance at work this year was horrific. Horrific. And if I were like trying to manage and control my work life, you know, and my attendance at work, that would be all self-reliant. And the truth is God-reliance is, I'm not really going to worry what my employer at work thinks of me, or my colleagues think of me, or what anybody thinks of me, or even what I think about me and my sudden lousy work ethic. But I'm going to be concerned with what God thinks of me. And God reliance to me like looks like taking the actions that are beneficial for what I believe my true assignment is. And I would encourage you, Victoria, I almost called you Gloria, and I know you, my encouragement to you is like really spend time asking God for specifics in areas where you are going into self-reliant. God, what would you have me be now? What would you have me be now? Maybe take it to some two-way prayer, write some things down that come to you, what it would look like if you were really relying on God, and just for today, practice it, and hope that helps.
Thank you, Victoria L. Mary F., your question, please. Star one to unmute, Mary F.
Hi, thank you so much. It's Mary S. from Delray Beach, Florida. Melissa, thank you. Oh, my God, this was so timely for me. I recently lost both of my parents within 7 months. My question to you is, what started, my mom died really quickly, which was, you know, a shock. But I had like 7 months with my dad as he, you know, faded and was more and more in dementia. My question for you is, for anyone out there, you know, I know what I went through. I was resentful and felt trapped at first, and then it turned to love. And anyone going through this process, what kind of advice would you give them to be accepting and loving? You know, you went from needing to be there to wanting to be there. You know, what kind of advice would you give them? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I'm sorry for your losses. It's, you know, my condolences. This is really God-reliant stuff. It's like, I would, you know, every time I went to be with my mom, every time I spent time with my mom, I tried to, like, see her as she was in that moment, in that time, not as she was the week before, as I was fearing she was becoming, but just in that moment, and to try to do the things that she enjoyed in that moment. Like, I realized there was, and I found these things out by not doing that. I mean, I want to tell you, like, that my learning never seems to come from great advice and wisdom that other people give me. My learning always seems to come by my own, like, screw-ups and failures. Like, I tried something, and oh, crap, that didn't work. And, you know, I had this experience where right before my mother got, like, really started to take a bigger decline, I went to a friend's father's funeral, a friend that was, like, knew my family growing up, was my neighbor, like, grew up with me, and his dad had also had dementia, and he had said to me, you know, I'm here anytime you need any help. And I tried, so here I go, right? I was with him when his dad died. We had this lovely conversation. He's someone I grew up with. And then I'm bringing my mom one day, something that she used to love to do. I used to take my mom out for pizza. And she used to like, we used to like to go to Wegmans. It was the supermarket. It was lots of people. I would take her out to Wegmans. I would get her pizza. I'd bring my lunch. We'd sit and talk, and I'd bring her back. And I brought her to Wegmans like we had always done, and holy smokes, she could not handle it. It was like I wasn't seeing her where she was at that moment. I was seeing her where she was maybe a week earlier, not the same person anymore. And my stumbling block was I tried to like fit a square peg into a round hole, and she was completely overwhelmed. She started to cry. She looked terrified. She had to be changed. I mean, it was horrible. And I walked out of there, oh my God, I really screwed up. What am I doing? You know? And I like was like, all right, Mom, don't worry about it. You know, we'll go back. And as I'm walking out, like, here's what God does for me. Who do I run into but my friend who just lost his dad? And he saw my exact predicament. He saw how was, and he walked with me to the car, and he's like, I'll help you, and he helped me, and he helped me get my mother back in the car, and I brought my mother back. And so what can I advise to people? See your parent as best you can, or whomever it is, as they are right now. Like, God is in the now, and so are the people that we love right now. It's like that one day at a time, no joke, one day at a time. Thanks, I'll pass.
Thank you, Mary S. Hanayeta R., your question, please.
Thank you, Leia, as always, for your service. And I have a question for you, but I'll call you later. Thank you so much, Melissa. What a heartfelt presentation. You said that you were a person who loved abundantly, that you had so much love in you. And I wanted to know how you feel about the fact that your sadness is in direct correlation to how much you love. Like the more you love, the more sad you get. I don't know if that fits you or not, but I was wondering what you feel about that.
Yeah, you know, thank you, honey. I don't know. You know what? I don't know. I think it's my thinking that only, like, people that love greatly feel sadness any deeper than anybody. I don't know what anyone else's sadness quite feels like. I know that I can, I'm like overly emotional, I think. You know, I kind of swing one way or the other, like overly emotional. But, yeah, I mean, listen, you know, this is the human experience. If you have the benefit of people that you love in your life, there's only two ways it's going to end. Either you go or they go. And so with having lots of people that I love, I'm going to have lots of experiences to lose and grieve. And, you know, now it's like I benefited. I had parents that I grew up in a really loving household. My parents adored me. My parents really loved me. And I feel a deep loss of that love. I felt extreme sadness over losing that. You know, I am nobody's baby anymore. I say that all the time, you know, I'm nobody's baby. That's done. But I also think there's a gift there because, you know, there's a space and it gets filled by my opportunity to be loving to other people in turn. So, yeah, I don't know. I think sadness is a fact. I can't pretend that I'm not sad for this idea that I'm supposed to sort of get my crap together and show up, but I can actually be sad and yet still get my crap together and show up. Yeah, hope that helps. Thanks, Henrietta. I don't know if I'm only one not hearing. I passed with that. Am I being heard?
I'm back.
Okay, good deal.
Okay, sure. Thank you. Okay, Deborah M., final question for today from Deborah M., please.
Yeah, thank you so much, Deborah M., Western New York, for a wonderful, wonderful, appropriate meeting. So I'm leaving work to live with my mom. I live with my mom, and she's going to be 89, and the needs are getting increasing. So my question is, I'm also a nurse, and her and I were never really close. She was a wonderful mom, but over the years, you know, we lived apart, and there was a lot of things going on. It was appropriate that we lived apart. Now we're living together. So my question is, surprisingly, as she's needy and asking me for things that she was never able to give me, love, compassion, understanding, wow. And now I'm called to do that, and I'm surprised. I want to do that. My gosh, I want to do that. But the memories of, my gosh, now you're asking, you know, where were you when you did that?
I'm going to tell you, I think it's really important that you inventory this stuff. You get with your sponsor. This is called a resentment. You've got to clean it up because, I've seen other people who tried to force things to change between, especially with my I have a sibling and a parent, my mom, who my sibling did not resolve these things. And it was very difficult for this person to deal with this. It was very difficult. We have a program. You cannot harbor resentments, whether they're justified. Like, we don't get the right of justifiable anger, and that she didn't show up. Like, if you have a sponsor, get with your sponsor and inventory this. You've got to have forgiveness. You cannot undo the past through the future. Like, it won't happen. That's for you to resolve. And I'm just going to say one thing, too. You know, love and life, it's not fair. Like, we can't look at it, well, they gave me this, so then in turn I can give them that. If you'd seen my inventory process before, trust me, my mother was not perfect. There was plenty of things that I had to, and just like me, I'm not perfect. There were plenty of things that I worked out through my inventory process so that I was able to be the daughter God designed me to be. And I would strongly encourage you, do your inventory. Thanks, I'll pass.
Thank you, Deborah M., for your question. Thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, Melissa, for this beautiful presentation this morning. So rich and profound. Very, very special. Thank you. Share ID for today, 22,564. That's 22564. We're going to close now from page 164. It's from a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.